Blog Talk Radio.
Rising report, it's that Apple report. It's the Rising Apple report. Rising report, it's that Apple report. It's the Rising Apple report.
Yeah! And good evening to my fellow Mets fans. This is Rising Apple staff writer Rich Farrago, and you are listening to the 127th edition of the Rising Apple Report. And tonight, joining me, we have a couple of very familiar voices to the Rising Apple Report. First, let me start with my esteemed colleague, Mr. Mike Lacolin. Mike, how are you doing tonight?
I'm doing well. Hello, Rich. How are you, sir?
Doing well. Baseball's in the air, and when that's happening, it just seems like the world's a better place. And also joining us tonight, another voice very familiar to the Rising Apple Report, one of the authors of Faith and Fear in Flushing and the author of a couple of other items that we'll talk about later on tonight, Mr. Greg Prince. Greg, how are you doing tonight?
Fine, Rich. How are you guys doing?
Doing well, thanks, Greg. Let's start the Rising Apple Report on a somber note, and that is that this past weekend, I believe it was Friday, the Mets community lost a very cherished member, and that is Shannon Ford from the Media Relations Department. Now, I had never met Shannon, and in speaking to Mike before we went on the air, Mike hadn't either. But although I had never met her personally, based on what I'm hearing from people who did know her, the television broadcast, Gary Cohen and Keith Hernandez did a little tribute to Shannon this past weekend, and something that really touched me is other teams did so as well. I know the Baltimore Orioles had a moment of silence for her with her picture on the scoreboard at their spring training park. Michael Kay even spoke very highly of Shannon before a Yankee broadcast this weekend. So clearly, although I did not know her, everyone speaks very highly of Shannon Ford, and it's quite a loss to the Mets community, but also to the baseball community. And Greg, what I'd like to ask you to do, because I know that you had met Shannon in some of your work as a writer, as a journalist, you had the opportunity to interact with Shannon. So I'm going to turn the floor over to you and just allow you to share whatever it is you'd like the listeners to hear about Shannon.
Well, you know, Shannon was everything that you've been hearing, the Mets fans have been hearing over the last few days. You try to imagine a better person, and you would have to have a far better imagination than I would. I can't say I knew Shannon very well, but you had the feeling you did when you spent any time with her at all. And I think that is a rare and precious gift. My interactions with her were a product of Faith and Fear in Flushing. We were one of the blogs that, for whatever reason, got on the list of blogs that were invited to take part in what they call Blogger Nights, I guess between 2010 and 2014. And she was the point person for all of that. And never for a second did you ever think that, you know, what you were doing as sort of this, you know, I sometimes refer to those as high school newspaper night, because I remember I went to one of those when I was in high school, you know, at Shea Stadium, and, you know, you were sort of like, you know, the consigned to the junior press box or whatever. You never felt like anything less than big league when you talked to Shannon. It didn't matter who you represented. It didn't matter who you were. Once you were in the ballpark, you know, you were as important as anybody who ran the team, who owned the team, to her. And just again, you know, I don't want to paint it as if we were old buddies, but again, you had that sense when you talked to her, just little exchanges, little chance meetings. I remember this one time I was on the field before a game for batting practice. I had nothing to do with any work. Some friends of mine had somehow managed to get us on the field through somebody they knew. And while we were standing behind the protective barriers, I saw some people who were familiar to me from, you know, communications department, other departments. And they're, you know, again, it's before the game. They're working. They're running back and forth. They have sort of tunnel vision where their responsibilities are concerned. I'll never forget that Shannon, out of the corner of eye or whatever, recognized me, came over, treated me as if, you know, I was some sort of VIP, made a big deal about me in front of my friends, which I thought was very nice of her and very funny. And then, you know, she showered affection on the people I was with. And, you know, again, she didn't have to do that. She could have just, like, waved and said, I'm busy now, or whatever. And then that was just so typical. Just small gestures, whether it was professional stuff or personal stuff. And, you know, I still remember the day in 2012, I don't know if you guys were affected by it, there was a brief period where Cablevision was not showing the WPIX games. So you were forced to listen to the radio, which is not a bad thing when you have Howie Rose and Josh Lewin, obviously. But for whatever it's worth, I had gone out that day and decided, you know, I'm not going to be tethered to the television because they're not on TV. I'm not going to sit around on a nice day and listen to the radio inside. I took my radio with me. And I'm walking along, and I suddenly hear Howie Rose say, "We want to wish all the best to a member of the Mets family." And I said, "I said, oh God, I hope it's, I hope this is nothing bad, and I hope it's, you know, nobody I know, because by then I got to know a few people." And said, "Oh, you know, Shannon Ford is going to be out for a while, but we know she'll be back." And you know, Howie said nice things about her. Josh said nice things about her. And, you know, I never, even though every now and then I would hear something about how she was doing and that it was certainly an uphill fight with breast cancer, I somehow couldn't picture her going down as a result of it, because she was just that kind of a person who just seemed too, I don't know, strong or strong-willed, but in the best way possible. And why would this, you know, why would this world go on without people like that? Which I realize is sort of a naive thing to say in the face of what happens every day. But she was just, you know, again, just this great presence and wonderful person to be around, and just incredibly sincere. And, you know, I had seen a quote from David Wright saying that, you know, Shannon was the person who would, you know, would set up the passes or whatever if he had friends coming to the game or relatives. And, you know, she was just doing her job. And he said that, you know, when the game was over, they felt like, you know, Shannon was their best friend. And they stayed in touch. And it just goes to show you that, you know, up and down the line, people had experiences like these. And these are the people who, you know, like myself, just had you know, scant interaction with her. And, you know, you, like you said, you know, we've heard the tributes from those who were, you know, in the press box every day and had reason to be dealing with her every day on a professional basis. So just, you know, such a sweet person, and God, what a loss, not only for the Mets, not only for Major League Baseball, but, you know, obviously for her family, for her friends, which are apparently legion, as they should have been. So, again, it's a tough blow, and yeah, you know, the caps tip to every organization that took a moment to honor her memory in Florida. I'm not surprised by that, because, you know, baseball, like really any industry, I suppose, where the same people see each other, does sort of have those family-like connections. And I remember that, you know, the night Bob Murphy died, the Mets were out of town, the Yankees were home, and the Yankees had a moment of silence for Murph. But, you know, you're talking about a Hall of Fame announcer, somebody of that ilk. Shannon is somebody who, again, what you said before is not uncommon, that I've been hearing the last few days. So many people said, I never met her, maybe I didn't know who she was, but wow, I sure wish I had, because she just had that impact. And you see that somebody who was so behind the scenes, somebody who, like, you know, reasonably most people never heard of, because who hears of, you know, the senior director of media relations in a given team? I'm not surprised she had that impact. So, again, all I can do is just chime in with what others have said, which is it's a great loss. She was a great woman. And I am, you know, when I count up the reasons, I'm happy to have, spend some time, writing about baseball. One of the prizes is getting to know people like Shannon Ford. So miss her terribly, and all I can do is hope for the best for her family, and may they have better days.
Thank you, Greg. Appreciate that. And our staff editor, Danny Abriano, is not able to join us tonight, but he also sent me something that he'd like me to read about Shannon. So from Danny Abriano, Shannon Ford had been unable to do the job she loved for quite some time. So those who knew she was sick had a feeling that the end was near. But that didn't make it any less of a gut punch when news of Shannon's passing broke. As many have recounted over the last few days, Shannon wasn't just a Mets employee. She was a shining light for the organization, for those who were a part of it and those who might only have known her in passing. A tiny footnote among the larger things Shannon accomplished during her career was her embrace of non-traditional media, the bloggers. If not for Shannon, I would have never made it into Citi Field to cover games, and almost certainly would not have made the connections necessary to open up the avenues that are helping to shape my career. And I wouldn't have met Shannon, who had an infectious smile and personality to match. A few minutes after Shannon's passing, I took a look back in my inbox to all the correspondence we had, and I was struck by the fact that even through email, where things are often lost in translation, Shannon's personality came through. Thanks for everything, Shannon, and let's hope the Mets win it all for you this season. That is from Rising Apple staff editor Danny Abriano. So with that said, clearly the tributes keep coming. I believe there's something for her tomorrow at Citi Field in her memory. And to echo what you said, Greg, and I'll ask Mike if he wants to add anything, but certainly the passing of a person who had a lot of impact on a lot of people, and at this point my thoughts go to her family, her husband, and her two small children, who, you know, baseball's great, it's a game, it's an institution, but there's a person who lost his wife and two children who lost their mom, and I think that's the most important thing here, and, you know, please ask listeners to have our thoughts with them. Mike, I don't know if you have anything you want to add to that.
Yeah, there you go. You said it. My heart goes out to their family, loved ones, friends. She passed away young. She passed away at 44. And, there's an old saying, your parents shouldn't outlive you. So that, I'm saddened by that. If it's a loss within the Mets family, it's a loss within our greater family. I think everyone listening either has had an experience with cancer or know of a friend or someone who's had an experience with cancer. So, those athletes, they wear pink for a reason. So, one day if you can take notice, and if that should inspire you to, take another step in your life to somehow, help to try to eradicate this enemy on human beings, I, for one, would applaud those actions. So I'm sad, and like you said, Rich and Greg, my heart goes out to their family and their loved ones, and we should all take a second to ponder our mortality and see what we can do better and see what we can do to enrich the lives of people around us.
Very well said. Similar sentiments were expressed by Jackie Robinson and Adorn Citi Field, so very well said, Mike. So with that, it's difficult to turn to something as trivial as baseball, and certainly in the context that we just talked about, it is incredibly trivial, but we are a baseball show, and it's time to focus on that a little bit. And we're in spring training now, and the games have started, and the 2016 season is literally around the corner. As I say these words, 3 weeks from this coming weekend, will be opening night in Kansas City, and the Mets will have a chance to renew their old friendships with the Royals of Kansas City. But before we get there, let's take a look back at 2015, and I can't think of a better way to do that than through Mr. Greg Prince, who has written a book called Amazing Again. It's the story of the 2015 New York Mets. And Greg, I believe the book is shipping now for those who have bought it through Amazon and is available. So what I'm going to ask you to do is to tell people, most importantly, how they can acquire a copy of your book. And if you'd like to share a couple of nuggets or a couple of ways the book is put together just to give an appetite whetter to our listeners, please do so. So, Greg, the floor is once again yours.
Well, thank you very much, Rich. I appreciate the opportunity. As you said, the book is called Amazing Again, available through Amazon, through BarnesandNoble.com, other fine online booksellers as of March 15th, which is a week from tonight as we record this. It will be in stores, I guess, certain bookstores, certainly in the New York area. I don't know the whole distribution angle, but it is a generally available book. And it is indeed the story of the 2015 New York Mets, following them really from the day the 2014 season ended with a mix of, well, here we go again, or, you know, here we go again into winter, another lost season too. But it kind of feels a little hopeful. And we follow that sense through the winter into spring training, and then, you know, the 162 games that follow and the bonus rounds of games that I don't think too many of us were expecting a year ago at this time. So in that sense, it's a fairly straightforward chronological retelling, with the caveat that it is told in what I would call modified first person. I am your narrator. I'm not, and I do not pretend to be a dispassionate observer. I make it very clear in the early going of the book that I write this as a highly engaged, historically minded, lifetime Mets fan, and that you, dear reader, are warned that I will fall into the trap of the first person plural, which is to say, I say we a lot without necessarily meaning to. You know, we won, we lost, we gained a game on the Nationals, we got Cespedes, that sort of thing. I wasn't trying to do that. It's just this, and I imagine you guys would back me up on this instinct, as would many of your listeners. This is just how we are. So with that, you know, that caveat clear, it's you know, it is biased, but it is objective. Certainly, you know, the downs get their treatment as much as the ups, and there were some downs early in the season. You know, it wasn't so long ago that I think I have to retrace all the steps right now. But as we know, the Mets had that very nice start in April of 2015. And then there were some stumbling blocks in May and June while they kind of groped around for their hitting shoes. And there was the bottoming out that we probably talked about on this show late July last year, between, you know, just a lack of offense and a problem holding on to leads in the rain and problems making trades that maybe shouldn't have been made anyway. And then, of course, this transformation into a behemoth, which is where the book kind of takes off to a whole other dimension, is really kind of explains why there is a book, because I don't think anybody would have been publishing a book about a second-place 82-win team, which is probably what the Mets felt like they were heading for before they made the moves that they had. And, you know, in the end, without giving away the ending, other than we kind of know what happened, you know, it becomes a very exhilarating season. Certainly, the last 2 months, the month of October, and even, you know, despite the bittersweetness of how it ended, you know, the feeling that lingers, I think, to this day. So, you know, that is the story of Amazin again. I think anybody who reads it will immediately be cast back into what they were feeling during a given week, during a given homestand, during a given inning. You know, I think some of that is just a reflection of, in my case, 11 years of blogging, where, you know, every game is sort of a one-act play that you're reviewing. So, you know, I felt, you know, not only writing it, but reading it, just this sense of being lost in the moment again, or the many moments. And, you know, when we talk about 1969 and 1973 and 1986, and, you know, the 99 and 2000 teams, we know how iconic those are from a distance. I think 2015 is, you know, instantly iconic. And it was very interesting to write about something without having historical perspective behind it, but kind of knowing that this is the sort of book that hopefully will, you know, be in people's, not only people's hands today, but, you know, on their shelves. And somebody, you know, I picture somebody picking it up off a bookshelf who maybe wasn't around in 2015 or was too young to know what the Mets were fully, and taking it off a bookshelf in the year 2020 or 2025 and saying, oh, so this is what it was like. And, you know, I have to kind of give a shout out to the books that I grew up on as a Mets fan, because I was just a kid in 69 and didn't quite grasp everything that was going on around me. So I took a bunch of books out of the library, you know, in the years that followed, and that those sort of filled in all the blanks for me. You know, what made 1969 a miracle, and, you know, why it was quote unquote amazing. And I try to imbue this story with that. And so, you know, it can be read by the reader of tomorrow, but more importantly, it can be read by the reader of today, hopefully, you know, soon. And again, it was just nice to have, after all these years of blogging about fourth place teams and teams that lost 88 games, it was just nice to have this story to tell. And it was, you know, fantastic to have the opportunity to tell it in one place, you know, not just night by night, as Jason and I do at Faith and Fear, but to be able to tell this story in one place, beginning to end of a season that I think, it, when we look back, is either going to be, wow, that was like the greatest year of our lives for many years as Mets fans, or the beginning of a great, hopefully the latter, the beginning of a great period. You know, nothing would make me happier than the chance to you know, write a sequel next year, obviously. But I think 2015 will stand on its own, and you know, stands in the pantheon, just as it will you know, be there with all the banners that hang from the over the third base side of Citi Field. So you know, it's the story of a team that wasn't expected to do anything, that struggled at times, but found itself and brought us a lot of happiness. And I think the book encapsulates that. So hopefully my explanation was not longer than the book, but there you have it. Amazin again, available now.
Excellent. And when you were talking about readers in 2025 potentially reading it, did anybody else get a little Zager and Evans going on in your brain there?
In the year 2025.
Right, it was always 25-25. But as soon as you said that, my mind went to Zager and Evans.
Young people today wouldn't know what the hell we were talking about. But that was actually, if I'm not mistaken, that was the number one song on October 16th, 1969, when the Mets won their first World Series. So that was in the year, that was a song in the year 2525 by a group called Zager and Evans that didn't have another hit. And we hope that the Mets of this era are not the Zager and Evans of baseball, and that they have more than one gold album in them. And hopefully starting in April, they will start climbing the charts again.
Well done. I love the segue back to the Mets. That was excellent, Greg. I did not know that Zager and Evans, I know it was from 1969, but did not realize that that song was atop the charts when the Mets won the World Series. So hopefully that's a good sign. And so I'm going to put you on the spot here for a moment and ask you to maybe extract one or two things from the book, just little things, moments that you may have focused on that maybe to those of us who are looking back at the season in its totality, maybe we missed those little things, but can you share with us, and maybe Mike and I could comment on them, one or two things that you chose to write about that maybe you think people may have lost in the larger landscape of the 2015 season and what those might be?
Sure. I will throw two things out there. One, from this time a year ago, we lost three pitchers. We lost Zach Wheeler, we lost Josh Edgen, and we lost Vic Black. All of them were part of, you know, the great young pitching that was going to propel the Mets toward possible contention or at least respectability. And, you know, certainly Wheeler is back at it now and, you know, is due back mid-2016. Edgen might be back a little sooner. Vic Black has left the organization. But it's interesting to me that these guys who were considered, you know, building blocks, you know, and again, you know, the bullpen is always a problem, really, a problem they never really solved right to the very end of the World Series. But they got to a World Series despite losing those three guys, and it was easy to kind of forget about them. I mean, when Zach Wheeler was mentioned as part of that trade that didn't go through, Flores and Wheeler for Gomez, I think it was the first time a lot of us even thought of Zach Wheeler. That was the end of July, probably the first time in 4 months. The other part that I really enjoyed writing, the segment of the season where roughly early July, well, really, we'll call it July, but until the Cespedes trade, which was a real kind of pre, let's call that the pre-transformational, or the part where the Mets, you know, did not fold up and go away when they could have. If you recall, we were coming out of a series against the Cubs in late June where the Mets scored one run in three games at Citi Field, lost all of them, and they were heading to California for two three-game series, one against the first-place Dodgers, one against the Giants, who I don't think were more than a couple of games behind the Dodgers, and the Mets were theoretically in a wild-card race, which is probably something that's already been forgotten, because, you know, the Mets were in a the Nationals were showing signs of pulling away. So, you know, you have to start worrying about, well, what did the Cubs do last night? What did the Giants do, or the Dodgers, or the Pirates? Because really, only the Cardinals were the only team that seemed to be a lock at that point. And it was, I think, a reflex of action on Mets fans' parts to say, oh, God, here we go again, because there were at least a couple of times in the relatively recent past where the Mets would be kind of good the first half of the season, go out west, and have their tails handed to them, and, you know, the season was over, basically. This time the Mets went out to L.A. and took 2 out of 3 on very strong pitching. Syndergaard on a Friday night, Mats on a Sunday. They go to San Francisco, where they still weren't really hitting, but there was like one terrific rally that was executed by the likes of Michael Conforto, Kirk Nieuwenhuis, and Johnny Manel, I believe, that rescued them one night, and Jacob deGrom kept them afloat in the finale, and suddenly they weren't dead, and there was something about that that said, you know what? For all that we've been worrying about with this team, they're only like 2 games out with 75 to play. There's still the wild card, but there's also still the East. And that kind of, again, I think that all of that and what followed, you know, there was a 3-game sweep of the Diamondbacks at home. There was sort of a up-and-down trip to St. Louis and Washington, including an 18-inning game that I think has probably been lost to history at this point, but I have a whole chapter about that. A showdown series against the Nationals before they had, you know, come to Citi Field. This was in Washington. And they were just hanging in there. But, again, it felt like they could have crumpled up and blown away, as so many Met teams had when they showed any sign of progress, and they didn't. And I don't know if that is a reflection on, you know, the fact that they had really good pitching for the most part, that they had just enough hitting, that Terry Collins did a good job of keeping their heads above water, But, you know, when the front office began making the moves that began to fortify the team, which, you know, in quick succession was, you know, calling up Conforto, trading for Uribe and Kelly Johnson, getting Tyler Clippard, and then, of course, the piece de resistance, Yoenis Cespedes, before we knew how many cars he had, they hung in there, and we were in a position. It was just, you know, I don't know that we could have foreseen it on June 30th, that we would get to July 31st and be, you know, no worse than three games out of first place, and as it turned out, poised to take off. And I think it's also fair to throw in this fact that the Nationals had every opportunity to put the Mets away during that period. And they never had a lead of more than 4.5 games. And you just kept waiting for, you know, Max Scherzer was in a groove and Bryce Harper was on his way to winning the MVP. And I know they had injuries, but they were supposed to be the gargantuan team in the National League East. And so the stars aligned and this team put it together. So I think it's easy enough to tell the story of the Mets with just the highlights, but and once they became who they were, which was really, you know, the Cespedes-driven Mets, which was a wonderful team to watch. But I think that period was almost their coming-of-age period, where they go to California and win those series, come home against Arizona, sweep that series, and, you know, don't get swept, basically, when they could have fallen apart against the likes of the Nationals and the Cardinals and the Dodgers. So it was that to me was the you know, the proving ground, and everything after that was sort of even though they switched to New York groove last year, they were really taking care of business, I think, when they the way they took care of the lousy teams for the longest time, the way they kept beating up on the Braves and the Phillies and the Marlins and the Brewers and the Reds, which was beautiful, because think of all the division titles the Mets didn't win because they couldn't beat teams like those in the last years of Shea. So it was a team that, you know, it's funny, we talk about them, you know, as this, you know, assumed contender, and rightly so, heading into 2016, and it's, you know, what a difference a year makes. Because we never talked like this in the modern era about the Mets as a team that knew how to win and knew how to play. And, you know, obviously they will have to prove it all over again because every team has to. But you know, somewhere last year they became a real team, or in Pinocchio terms, they became a real boy. And it was, again, a lot of fun to watch happen, even though you were stressing out over it while it was happening. And God knows, I had a great time writing about it, and I hope folks will have a great time reading about it.
You know, before I turn to Mike, I just want to say, when you talked about a Cespedes-driven team, that was no pun intended, right?
No, it wasn't, actually. That's pretty good.
So Mike, I'm going to give you a chance here to comment on, in thinking about the 2015 team before we officially turn this podcast to 2016, maybe you can reflect upon the extractions that Greg talked about, the little things that maybe get lost in the shuffle, such as, you know, Greg, it was very revealing when you said, because I had forgotten that in spring training, the middle of spring training last year, the Mets did lose three arms, and you forget about that. And then the series you're talking about, Greg, where they lost to the Cubs and they just looked deader than a doornail, and then everybody said the death knell was ringing because they were about to go to the West Coast, Dodgers, Giants, they were going to go 0-6 and blah, 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 and then they went 4-2 on that trip, and that sort of told us that, hey, there might be something special to this team. So I think those were two excellent points to bring out as some of the subtleties of the 2015 season. And then finally from me, and then I'll turn over to Mike, you know, the 2015 season was a roller coaster in the beginning. You know, the great start, then the valley, and then it became just a thrill ride, you know, from late July on. And I think as we look back, you know, we tend to look at the postseason. We tend to look at that and the series against the Nats at the end. But there were so many, and I hate the word microcosm, everybody uses it too much, but there were so many microcosms throughout that season that just tell you what baseball's all about. You know, it's you're up, you're down, you're both. You don't know what's coming next, and that's the beauty of the baseball season. So, Mike, 2015 to you, what are some things that happened in that season that maybe you remember that might be more on the subtle side?
They were resilient throughout. You've heard me say a million times on these podcasts, you can't win pennants in April, but you can certainly lose them. And obviously they got off to that very good start in April. And that gave them a big cushion to work with. We knew they weren't going to sustain that high level of play. So at least at a minimum, we knew that we had a cushion to work with. And the reason why we posted an above 500 record in April, yes, the pitching was legitimate. But compared to the rest of the National League, we were a middle-tier offense. That dipped in May, and that dipped even further in June. June is when we really hit rock bottom. And then we posted a 500 record again in July. And lo and behold, offensively, we were a middle-tier offense. So we knew what the problem was, and we knew what the potential solution could be, which was acquiring a slugger. We had been saying it throughout the season and spring training and till we were blue in the face. To me, before I move on, Curtis Granderson was a large reason why, we remained, as Greg said, two games out. As the trade deadline approached. So let's give him his kudos. And the team as a whole, let's give them their kudos, because throughout those first 4 months of the season, they spent all of one day in third place. Otherwise, they spent all their time in second or first place. So we knew we had something there, but all fingers were pointing towards ownership. We were on the other side of a long rebuilding period, and now, they could not hide any longer, and the performance on the field was begging for action. And lo and behold, they supplied it. They came through. They stepped up, and, the rest, as they say, is history. They just, exploded in August and September, and it got us a National League championship. And for that, I'm very grateful that everyone from ownership on down, stepped up and performed the way they did. You say microcosm, Rich. I tend to think of it as a jigsaw puzzle, and it took us a while to figure it out and see where all those pieces fit. In one corner you have Syndergaard, Conforto, and Mats, the rookies and their late contributions. And then you look at DeGrom and Harvey as the mainstays of the rotation since day one. You look at the work that Familia did on his own, and then what the acquisitions did. So it was an interesting way it all came together. It was great. It snuck up on us. But I don't think it took anyone by surprise. We were expecting by this time things or proactive measures, I should say. We had expectations at this point that something else needed to give. And had the Wilpons and ownership as a whole failed to do anything and maintain status quo they had done in years previous, they would have had a major, major uprising on their hands. So good job by them. By putting that step forward and finally dictating the future course of this organization, even if it's just short term. So, let's just live in the moment. Let's just live in 2016 and enjoy it for what it is. We'll cross future bridges when we get to them.
Fair enough. And so we're about halfway through the podcast, and we do have a caller on the line. And I'm going to invite the caller to join us, and perhaps there's a comment on the 2015 season or something the caller would like to say to either myself, Mike, or especially Greg. So we have a caller from the 631 area code. Caller, you're live. Can you let us know who you are?
Michael.
Mike, long hey, time, Michael. All the time. Welcome back.
What's up?
How you doing, Michael?
Good, you?
Good, good. So what do you have for us? What are your thoughts on 2015 or Greg's book or any of the stuff we've been talking about?
Well, it's kind of off topic, but it's about the Cardinals and Ruben Tejada. Do you see any chance the Cardinals would trade for Ruben Tejada?
All right, so that's a good lead-in. So let's hold that thought for a minute. And I did want to turn the page on this podcast to 2016. And there are a couple of topics, and Ruben Tejada on the Rising Apple site, and we wrote up the topics for this podcast, and certainly Tejada was one of them. So let's start there. So, and Greg, I'll go to you first on this one. Ruben Tejada, kind of an embattled figure for a lot of different reasons. You know, we had the whole Sandy Alderson a couple years ago saying that getting him to do extra work was like pulling teeth. Terry Collins at one point seemed to not like Ruben, and then now he does. And then there's the financial side of it. The financial side is he's making $3 million to be a fifth infielder, and that just does not seem consistent with the Alderson philosophy of building a ball club. Then there's the on-the-field side. You know, Tejada's a solid defensive infielder, has demonstrated that he could play all three positions, which is fine. Not much of an offensive player, and the Mets have options. You know, they have a Matt Reynolds, a guy who's probably more athletic than Tejada, not as good defensively, probably better offensively, and can maybe play a little outfield. So, Greg, I'm going to go to you on this, especially with the injury that Michael mentioned to Peralta. The Cardinals, I'm not sure what they have in their minor league system, but they apparently have a gap at shortstop. So with everything I've said, Greg, if you could opine on what you think might happen to Ruben Tejada before April 3rd.
He does seem ripe to not be with the Mets when they get to Kansas City. Just the salary seems to hang heavy in the air, you know, precisely because of what you said, because he is now for sure a utility infielder, which of course, you know, those he might seem overpriced only until you need a utility infielder. You know, you've got Flores and Tejada basically doing all the backing up at four positions, I suppose, because I don't think anybody else is a backup first baseman other than possibly one of the catchers. And, you know, so, you know, Flores, you're looking at playing, you know, any of four positions, and Tejada any of three positions. You know, I don't – first of all, I don't know what the odds are that he winds up with the Cardinals, because I have to believe there are more utility infielders or fill-in shortstop types out there than just Ruben. But it does seem that – and it would be sort of, you know – bittersweet irony that the Mets have gotten as far as they did with Ruben Tejada, and as he was sort of the bloody shirt who we waved last October after Chase Utley slammed into him and didn't get suspended, as it turned out, by the way, for him not to be there to you know, walk to the foul line on April 8th at Citi Field without a cane and get a rousing ovation. But, you know, it does feel like he, after, you know, David Wright has been a Met longer than anybody else on the active roster, projected active roster. Number two is Ruben Tejada. That's how long he's been on this team. You know, he was up, he made the 2010 team out of spring training. If you may remember, Jose Reyes was still coming off of, I remember if it was a thyroid situation or what was holding him back that spring. But anyway, the point being that Tejada has been here a long time. It's hard to imagine him anywhere else, but we've probably said that about 100 other players in our lives. So I wouldn't take him for granted. I know, you know, Matt Reynolds feels like he's been waiting in the wings for maybe 3 years at this point. But I don't know. I have a hard time seeing him making the roster because of all that's been said, but I also have a hard time letting go at this point, which is hard to believe because he's Ruben Tejada. It's like, you know, isn't this, doesn't he come with the real estate? Doesn't he come with Citi Field? It almost feels like it. But, you know, again, I'm always wary if the Cardinals want a player, then we must be missing something. I'm worried now watching Jeremy Hefner pitch for them because, oh, my God, Jeremy Hefner is the one who got away because the Cardinals see something they can do with him. But, you know, we're going to have to find out. So it'll be interesting. I have no insight on this. I've read the same rumors that Michael did. And we'll have to see.
And Michael LeColin, what do you think? Ruben Tejada's future, what do you think, Mike?
I really don't care.
How about Mike LeColin? Mike, want to jump in on this one?
you know, I wouldn't be in such a rush to delete Ruben Tejada from Mets premises. Albeit his role here is largely diminished, he still has value to this club in terms of late inning defense and a replacement and a pinch hitter. I mean, Terry Collins trusts him. There's something to be said for that. And I'm just trying to, you know, keep this on a pragmatic level. I mean, this year's salary is going to pay for itself. The increase in attendance is going to offset everything, and, you know, they're going to come to a break-even point. So I don't think his $3 million salary is really that much of an issue, unless they have other ideas. I think Daz's salary is a little bit more higher up on their, you know, contracts that need deletion, if you know what I mean. But there's still value in retaining Tejada. As Greg says, he's been here a long time. He's, for the most part, a fan favorite. You know, he hasn't turned off many fans through the years. If anything, we have a soft spot in our heart for him. I think still we embraced him after the way Jose Reyes left. And, you know, he's still riding that coattail. Can the Cardinals use him? Yeah, perhaps. They're a savvy club. You know, they would pick him up short-term. You know, they don't have a prohibitive financial situation that would preclude them from spending $3 million on a guy like this. But I wouldn't be in such a rush to see Tejada go. That's all I'm saying. Can I move on? Yeah, I can move on. But I can also see him staying as well.
Fair enough.
Can I just throw in one thing, Rich, that sure. A year ago at this time, I think we were all done with Ruben Tejada, or at least the sense was that, well, with Wilmer Flores at shortstop, Murphy at second, Dilson Herrera on the horizon, you know, what is left for Ruben Tejada? And as you pointed out, he played three positions last year, started all of them. Other than Granderson and Flores, I think he was the only regular who didn't miss any time. He wasn't Johnny Peralta offensively, and wasn't Andrelton Simmons defensively, but he was able to be plugged in. So again, you know, I wouldn't let the entire future of the Mets hinge on Ruben Tejada one way or another. But he was handier than we realized, and it's something to keep in mind, like Mike said.
And therein lies the beauty of the matter. I mean, with an overall improved roster, his role changes. Our expectations for him changes. So the context of Ruben Tejada changes.
Understood. And I think we've all landed on he has some utility to the team. Is it $3 million worth of utility? That's for Sandy Alderson to decide, because they do have options. So it's not like Tejada's useless. It's just it's going to become a value proposition with him. And that value proposition will be decided by the front office. And from what I understand, if they make a move with him, I don't think they'll release him, but if they did by the 15th of March, they'd only be liable for a small percentage of his salary. If they hold on to him past the 15th of March and then were to release him, they would be liable for most of his salary. So that is something to think about.
I think if he's on opening day roster, somewhere down the line we'll find out that Terry Collins lobbied for him.
I think you're right, because Terry must identify with Ruben. Terry was an undersized middle infielder, and Tejada's kind of the same. Although I've never seen fire in Ruben's eyes, and I guess Terry had a lot of fire in his eyes when he played. And that's always been my gripe with Ruben is he has some talent, he can do some things, but I don't know, there's something about that guy that he looks like he doesn't have a killer instinct when he's out there, and that's something I've always appreciated in a ballplayer. So, Long Island, Michael, that's your new name as our caller. Anything to add on the Tejada situation?
Like you said, utility in case someone gets injured. That's a good thing. But, like, $3 million in our financial situation is too much, in my opinion. So I would trade him and get salary relief for something.
Fair enough. I know, and they might be thinking exactly that way. So so we'll see on this one. I think spring training, I think, does carry a little bit more of a meaning to Ruben Tejada than to most of the New York Mets for those exact reasons that we've outlined. I do think I don't want to say his job is on the line, but he is playing for something. He is not guaranteed a spot on this roster. So we'll see how that plays out. So let's move to another topic for the 2016 team, and that would be Kevin Plawecki. Now, Mike, I'm going to go to you first on this one. Plawecki is someone who filled in, I'll call it admirably, if not spectacularly, for TDA when TDA was out for what seemingly was most of last season, but although statistically it was about half. And the thought is, okay, so if TDA is going to be the catcher, does Plawecki benefit more by being a major league backup and playing probably twice a week, or does Plawecki benefit more by going back to AAA? That old adage about, you know, he's not learning anything on the bench. He'll send him back to AAA, let him play, let him learn, and I don't know, maybe develop him as a trade piece for later or trade TDA in a season or two and use Manel on the major league roster, at least coming out of the gate on April 3rd. So Mike, what do you think about that, Mike LeColin? What do you think about the Kevin Plawecki situation, how the Mets should handle it?
It's interesting. I'm not interested in playing the hot hand. Therefore, I believe Plawecki should start at Las Vegas for the sake of playing every day and let TDA start the season as the starting catcher. That said, I still think catcher is an open competition. I don't believe TDA has won anything just yet. He still needs to prove himself, and he needs to improve his throwing. Both of them, incidentally, need to improve their throwing. That said, you know, if Travis wins the job outright, fine, good for us. Now, if Plawecki also shines at Las Vegas, you know, perhaps we can pull, you know, the smoke and mirrors routine and mask the fact that he's doing all that at Vegas and perhaps cash in on a trade, either package him or straight up for something, you know, whatever the case may be. But it would be beneficial for the Mets and Kevin Plawecki as an individual and an athlete if he performs well, and he performs well on a daily basis at Las Vegas. That's all that's in their control. Just play. Play, play, play. That's the only thing that they can control. So just do that. So, you know, that would require the Mets going out and getting a veteran catcher, hopefully a cheap one, but veteran, and I use that with a capital V. Somebody, you know, up in age, 35, 36, somebody who knows how to handle pitchers and whatnot, who knows his craft, who understands it and doesn't need to be taught anything, coached or supervised or anything of the above. But playing, I think, is the optimal way to go. So you start, you know, Travis with the big club. You start Plawecki at Las Vegas. Should Travis struggle, you know, there's options there. Swap them out. Give them both a fair shot. But ultimately, this situation needs resolution. And should both of them shine, better for us. It opens up options on what we can do or how we can utilize Plawecki otherwise.
Mr. Prince, it's yours.
You know, I'm trying to think of a relatively recent example of sort of a catcher 1A, especially on a contending team. And I'm not sure I have one. I mean, you know, I automatically, as I fear as we get older, we go back to situations that are rather out of code. And I remember the Orioles in the, you know, 1970 winning with Andy Etchebarren and Elrod Hendricks, or the Zager and Evans of catching in terms of their current their contemporary meaning to people. And, you know, I guess through the years, you know,
I think the Phillies had a situation like that with Bob Boone and McCarver, if I'm not mistaken.
Well, McCarver had a very specific job, which was catching Steve Carlton.
Right.
So you knew he was going to catch one of every five games. I'm thinking, you know, the Yankees in the late 90s when they were kind of transitioning from Girardi to Posada, it wasn't exactly a platoon. But you don't see too many of those. And then, again, this wouldn't really be a platoon because it's not a righty-lefty situation. I like the idea of having some flexibility, of freeing, you know, one guy up to, you know, pinch hit maybe, or at least be in the lineup at the same time with the other guy. But it doesn't seem like that's really ever going to happen if Darno is healthy. I think Darno is not far away from being an elite catcher in this league and being the kind of guy who goes to, I guess it's San Diego this year. We'll go to San Diego in midseason to perhaps back up Buster Posey and, you know, be on the bench with Yadier Molina. He one of the things that comes up in my book is, remember that one of the guys they lost, and you mentioned it before, they lost Darno for most of last year. And the great start they had was, you know, Darno and David Wright, and both of those guys are out. Jerry Blevins was out. Without getting off track here, the point being that it seems like Darno keeps kind of running into a stumbling block with not chronic injuries, but just something seeming to go wrong. And hopefully that just ends. It's not that, if it's not a chronic thing, there's no reason it has to keep going. So best case scenario to me, Travis Darno becomes your catcher, which begs the question, is Pilecki just a part-time catcher, sometime first baseman or something they invent for him, or, you know, ultimately, you know, does he have to go find somewhere else to play? In the short term, you know, I hate to send him down because I think he showed some good stuff behind the plate last year, but if he's not going to play, I mean, that's a Johnny Manziel role, previously filled by Anthony Recker. And, you know, let him go down. I mean, the Mets seem to be forging a pretty good AAA club in terms of having the next wave of players, possibly, especially when you think of somebody like Dilson Herrera. So it wouldn't be the worst thing in the world. But again, Pilecki, while, again, I can't say he proved himself he can't go down, because anybody can go down. I'd rather him play than sit. I know Pilecki has said, you know, he'd rather... I call him Pilecki, excuse me. You know, he'd rather be at the major league level and absorb what lessons there are. And who could blame him? Who the hell wants to go back to AAA? But it's tough to see a guy like that at his young age sitting, especially if they have plans for him or ultimately plans to move him for something they can use. So I guess I lean toward Las Vegas, but don't tell Kevin I said that, because I don't think he'd like it.
Probably not. And Long Island, Michael, do you have an opinion on this matter?
I really don't like any of our catchers.
Get rid of them both. That solves it, right?
Yeah. See, this is wishful thinking. But before Matt Harvey's contracts get up, why not trade for a elite catcher? Because I'm not sure if we have any good catchers in our farm system. Like I said, not a fan of any of them.
Fair enough.
Darno was out for most of the year.
Neither one is a perfect player, you know, because CDA can't throw anybody out. And Pilecki, as far as I'm concerned, hasn't really shown much with the bat, but that might be a bit unfair because he really hasn't had an opportunity. But you know, Michael, I don't think you're wrong when you say that, you know, maybe we don't have great catching on this team. You know, maybe neither one is that good. And I actually think that's insightful. I think that's well done. So we actually have another caller from the 516 area code. I'm not sure if you'd like to talk about Zager and Evans, caller. I mean, I can't get past that. I just think that's wonderful that we're talking Zager and Evans tonight. But from the 516 area code, you're on the Rising Alpha Report. Can you let us know who you are and what you'd like to talk about?
Hi, guys. It's Gary Mack, and I just wanted to say hello to everybody.
Gary.
Hey, Gary.
How are you?
Hi. How are you guys doing tonight? Zager and Evans, huh?
Yeah,
we're 25-25.
Well, little known fact, that song was inspired by Oliver Perez's ERA.
Well, I was just, I've been following a little bit about this whole Pilecki talk, and, you know, I really can't make up my mind. I'm kind of confused with the whole thing. I agree with Michael. I think he should play, and Las Vegas probably would be the best spot for him. But I don't know. Travis Darno with the injuries, wow, it's kind of tough. But I do think the reason he didn't hit was, I think his main job when he came up was to be defensive, just to learn the pitching staff, and he put all his focus on that. And I think if he does come back this year, I think we'll see a better hitter, and his sinuses are all cleared up now. So perhaps that has something to do with it. But, boy, that's a tough decision.
It is. And I'm very fascinated to see what they do with that, because you could say that, you know, Plawecki is, although it's not good for him to sit on the bench, is it good for the team for him to be on the bench as opposed to a Manel, or as Michael Colin said, you know, going out and getting a 35-year-old Henry Blanco type of a guy. Of course, Henry's probably 45 mm-hmm. now, but somebody of that ilk when they had Henry. So I always liked Hank White, by the way. I don't know why, but I just liked him. So,
yes.
So Gary, can you stay with us for a few minutes?
Yeah, I can stay.
Okay, good. Let's wheel around the next. I'll throw it around to the entire crew on the phone. So it's everybody's favorite topic, and I think if there are 30 podcasts going on for the various teams, they're all talking about this right now. Maybe not the Yankees, though. It's about the bullpen. So the Yankees seem to have figured theirs out, but most other teams still have a few openings. And the Mets don't have a lot of competition for spots on the roster this year, which is great. But if there is any competition, it is in the bullpen. Sean Gilmartin is someone who, you know, might be on the bubble. You have Blevins as a lefty. You have Estardo as a lefty. So Gilmartin is, you know, he's tenuous. You have a guy like a Goodell. You have a guy like a Logan Verrett. You know, these guys are competing for the quote-unquote mop-up man, middle relief kind of a thing. So what I'm going to do here is I think I'll start with Mike again. And, Mike, as you look at the bullpen and the bullpen candidates, I don't think the Mets are in bad shape in the pen, but they do have to make some decisions. They have more pitchers than they have spots. So do you have a solid, you know, a strong feeling either way about what they should be doing with this?
No, only because I gave up this science years ago. I gave up on relief pitchers. But I'll only say this. I'm more interested in how they go into April, because the bullpen, as it's going to be constituted in April, will not be the bullpen, you know, we're going to come to recognize in August and September. So that's where my focus is. Somewhere down the line, hopefully we're going to get Josh Edgen, and he'll, you know, add a level of effectiveness, hopefully from the left side. You know, Rafael Montero put out a big question mark out there the other day, but, you know, the hope is he'll be better and we'll be able to utilize him. You're right. We have more bodies than we have slots. That's a good problem, Rich, you know, so I don't think, you know, you can make a wrong decision here, especially with the way relief pitchers go. You just never know. It's a crapshoot. It's a roll of the dice. You know, hopefully we're going to have a good time and roll sevens, you know. I don't know.
Well, I think, Mike, like you said, what it points to is depth, and you made an excellent point that, so if the bullpen, you know, seven guys, maybe eight guys coming out of Port St. Lucie, you know you have depth in AAA because a couple of these guys won't make it. And if some of the pieces aren't working in Queens, you dip down to Vegas and pull up a couple of guys who were contemplated for the role coming out of spring training. So having depth is never a bad thing. And I think that's what it speaks of. And I think that's a good problem to have. So, Gary, we'll go to you next on this. What are your thoughts on the bullpen and those couple of spots that are open?
I think the bullpen is in much better shape than we started last year. And I really think Gilmartin is probably going to end up in Vegas as a starting pitcher. I think Montero, there's a lot of question marks. They want this kid to succeed, but, boy, he's just not showing anything so far. It's early yet, though. He can come along, but he's struggling a little bit this spring so far. Probably Verrett goes back. I would think they would hold Goodell up here because he's done the job already. I think the key thing to remember about this also is, like you said, Rich, they can dip down, and if they have to dip down, they're getting guys that actually have major league experience. So they're very young, but they have this major league experience, and I think that's a very a good thing to have, and a lot of teams don't have that. You know, they could have Akil Morris down there as well, and Alvarez. So there's going to be a tons of guys they're going to have that have a taste of the major leagues, and when they get called up, if they have to be called up, they're not going to be overwhelmed.
You're right. I think we're agreeing that it's a good problem to have. I mean, maybe these guys aren't excellent relief pitchers, but how many you know, seventh or eighth bullpen guys are in the major leagues. The Mets have enough quality guys, enough average to above average guys to pick from, to a point where you don't have to stick with someone who might be struggling because you have so much depth. So, Greg, what are your thoughts on this?
I agree that depth is a wonderful thing, and that, as we've talked about many times before, the bullpen second half of the year, the bullpen the latter half of the first half of the year will not look like it does on opening day. It just never does. I'd like to see, you know, next few weeks how this begins to shake out in terms of performance, because I think this is the one area where, you know, a job will be won as opposed to a job is already in place in the back end of the bullpen. Ideally, you know, I heard Mike use the phrase "roll sevens." You know, let's get these starters to throw seven innings uniformly, possibly eight, and it becomes less and less of an issue. So, you know, the one guy whose name sticks out for me is Logan Verrett. I just like what he did last year. Granted, limited exposure, but in a number of roles, and just in that mold of, you know, will do whatever he's asked to do, and, you know, did it at the very least adequately, sometimes even better. So I don't know if he'll make the opening day roster, but I would suspect that we will see him before long. He seems like a handy guy to have around. And then I'm curious to see what Gil Martin can be. It seemed like they really kind of held Gil Martin in abeyance last year. You know, it's like they didn't want to expose him too much. He had to be on the roster for Rule 5 purposes. And he's another guy who could give you some versatility. But, you know, I would like that I think is one of the few things that you can learn from spring training games is as it gets a little closer to opening day and you're actually seeing lineups a couple of times through and you're seeing some hitters that you would see in later in games still in the game, and see what these guys can do against, you know, actual major league hitting. So, again, just to echo what everybody else has said, a pleasant problem. I don't feel it's a disaster waiting to happen, and that is definitely an improvement over past years.
For sure. Long Island Michael, what are your thoughts here?
My opinion is the bullpen is much better than what it was last year at this time. I remember last year when we had Alex Torres, a.k.a. I like to call him Mario because of his hat he wears. We just picked up Bastrato, which got overruled by Cespedes, basically. He didn't get enough mentioning. Our starters can go easily seven innings. You have Reed, Robles, Bastrato, and Familia in the bullpen. You're fine with our pitching.
That's my opinion. I appreciate it, and I'll tell you what, it's rare when you have five fans of a team on talking about it, and we all agree on a point. So, well done. I think we all agree that the bullpen is not in bad shape, and depth's a very good thing. So, guys, we're turning the corner toward the end of the podcast, and we have a couple more things to do. And one of them, I feel like I have to throw this out on this podcast because it's a newsworthy item that happened this week. So, here it is. Chase Utley, the suspension was overturned, vacated, whatever you want to call it. And I know that is going to inspire emotional reactions by a lot of people. So what I'm going to ask you guys to do is just give me your quick thoughts on it. I'm sure we can go into it, probably do a full podcast on it. We don't have a whole lot of time left. So my thought on the Chase Utley suspension being vacated is this. Do I think he was trying to hurt Ruben Tejada? I do not. I think there's no history there, first of all, between the two players. Second of all, that's a premeditated act. You know, I'm going to hurt this guy. I'm going to do whatever I can to hurt this guy. I do not think that's what Utley was trying to do. I do think that, by definition, that was a double play because Utley was not in contact with the bag, went out of his way. It's interference on Utley, and it should have been called a double play. And the umpires missed it. Torrey, in his way, in his explanation, was all over the place. But by rule, that should have been a double play. So should Utley be suspended in my mind? I know this is not going to be popular with the fan base. I really don't think so. I think it was something where He was not trying to hurt him. Yes, he went out of the baseline. Should have been called a double play. They missed it. Is that suspension worthy? In my opinion, it really is not. And I know I'm going to get a lot of hate mail for that one, but I want to get you guys to react to that. And, Greg, I'm going to go to you first on it. What are your thoughts?
Oh, hold on. I'm just now finishing my hate mail to you, Rich. That is no. I understand where you're coming from. I say that, you know, if you're going to go to the trouble of changing the rules to reflect that Chase Utley did something that was considered out of bounds, even if they couldn't quite nail down what he did in statutory terms, I don't think, making him sit for two games is out of line. It just feels like, going back 15 years to Roger Clemens throwing at Mike Piazza and then throwing the bat at Mike Piazza and then having nothing done about it from an official standpoint. And somehow Joe Torre was there for that. Joe Torre is here for this. If one were in the mood to build a conspiracy theory around Joe Torre, one would be, I think, kind of justified. But, in my dreams, somehow Roger Clemens is activated by some other team, and Roger Clemens comes to bat, and Chase Utley is pitching and throws it at Roger Clemens, hits him in the helmet, and then Roger Clemens takes his base. Utley goes to second, or one of them slides into the other. We just get all the closure we wanted. But aside from my desire for revenge fantasies and so forth, I think it's good that the rule has changed. I'm not sure how the neighborhood play situation is going to be handled after all these years. If we're just asking for more Mr. Goss with the with more replay, versus the need to get it right. So I think it's kind of a mess. I think you could have kept the suspension. I don't think it would have been a crime against baseball. But I also know that we won that series. And coming away with that, to me, is the real prize. So I imagine that Chase Utley is prepared for anything when he steps into the batter's box at Citi Field in late May against, hopefully, Noah Syndergaard in particular, or Hansel Robles, even better. So we'll see.
Good, fair take on that. Mike LeColin, what do you think?
Look, our new commissioner, Mr. Manfred, he's still new at this. He's still learning how to wield his power. I'm glad the decision was reversed. It was knee-jerk. But that said, let's move forward under this new protocol. That's fine. But, when you're asked, I'm a troglodyte, and I've seen much more egregious instances than what utterly perpetrated. I'm never in favor of changing the rules of baseball, but be it as it may, like I said, let's move forward. I'm just glad they got a backbone and decided to lift the suspension because it was knee-jerk.
Fair enough, and I agree with that, Mike. So we'll go to Gary. What are your thoughts?
Well, sorry, I agree with Greg. I think they see the suspension was called for. And especially since he did the same thing a couple of weeks earlier against, I think it was San Diego and the second baseman there, Jerko.
Definitely a repeat offender.
Pardon me?
Definitely a repeat offender.
Yeah, and I think for that reason alone, and in the stage that it occurred in, I think for that he deserves a two-game suspension. For him to get off scot-free is really kind of an outrage, I think. And I hope, like Greg said, I don't think he should dig in too tightly when his first time is up, especially against, if it's Syndergaard, especially. But don't dig a hole in there because you're going to be on the ground pretty quick.
I'll, Gary, what's the story behind that one? Who dug a hole and thought better of it? It was against Bob Gibson, wasn't it?
Jeez.
I'm going to jump in on that.
Yeah, I think
I think it was Willie Mays. The story, as I recall, and Greg, I know you're a resident historian, but as I recall the story, it was Willie Mays digging in against Don Drysdale. So he's digging in. And
Don Drysdale, right.
Yeah, that might.
And Drysdale's on the mound, and he filled the hole back in. But Greg, am I right on that, or do you recall that?
That sounds right.
Yeah. I think that's a great story.
Isn't that great? It shows you how the game has changed, because now if you now Syndergaard misses Escobar by probably 6 inches in game three, and there's an outrage. You know, the Royals, Moustakas is pointing at him like he's an arch criminal, you know, because he came within 6 inches of somebody. So, Long Island Michael, your thought on the Utley suspension being vacated?
MLB made a huge mistake. There is going to be revenge. It may not be against Utley either. If I was Syndergaard and it was Kershaw, hit Kershaw right in the arm.
Well, there you go. Eye for an eye.
That's my opinion.
Okay, guys, we have two more things to do on the report, on the Rising Out report tonight. We're going to do our typical number tribute to the number 27. So I'm going to ask you guys to give me your thoughts on a Met or two, who has worn the number 27 and why that person sticks out to you. And we'll do that in just a moment, because right now we also like to talk about the corresponding number of that season in New York baseball history. So 1927 was a year in New York baseball history that I think belongs to the Yankees, right? It was Murderer's Row. It was 27 Yankees. They're legendary. They're used as an adjective now. You know, that was 27 Yankees-like. You know, they've become a hyphenated adjective. So I think we know where New York baseball was then. But Sam Maxwell sent me something that I just want to read real quickly here. And he said that the New York Giants that year came in third place with 92 wins. Imagine that, winning 92 games, finishing third. And he said that the Robins, and the Dodgers were still not the Dodgers then. It was the Brooklyn Robins still in 1927. And they had a bad year. Sam did not give their numbers, but he said they had a really bad year in Brooklyn. So that's sort of an overview of baseball in 1927 in New York. Great year for the Yankees, a decent year for the New York Giants, and a really bad year for the Brooklyn Robins. So for the younger listeners, take that one to the bank. Now, number 27. I'm just going to throw a couple names out here. You know, there's definitely some interesting ones. Dallas Green, guy who managed the Mets, wore 27 in 1966. How about that? The one that will stick out to, I believe, Gary, Mike, Greg, and me is Craig Swan. Craig Swan was a good pitcher on a very bad team from the team was bad, 77 through 82. So Craig Swan, you know, Godspeed to you, sir. You did a good job on a very bad team. A couple other names on here. Pete Harnish, who left the organization kind of burning bridges when he walked out the door, if you remember Pete. He had a lot of bad things to say about Bob Apodaca and Bobby Valentine, who were pitching coach and manager of the team when they let him go. And another name I'm going to throw out, the man who is now in the SNY booth, Nelson Figueroa, wore 27 for the Mets in 2008 and 2009. And final one, I'll throw Pedro Beato in there for one reason. I was at a game in San Francisco, Mets game in San Francisco, and Pedro Beato, during batting practice, threw a ball to my niece. So he has a special place in my heart. We were watching batting practice, and he threw her ball because she was wearing a Mets shirt. So those are my top-line recollections of some Mets to wear 27. So, Mike LeCollin, I'm going to start with you on this one. Of any of these guys or any other who wore 27, who sticks out to you and why?
Let's go with the obvious. Jerry's Familia. This excludes Long Island Mike. Does Jerry's Familia remind anybody of Lee Smith, or is it just me?
Little bit.
I can say that.
Yeah, there's definitely something there.
Let me see. Who else? Nelson Figueroa, homeboy, Brooklyn in the house. Let me see. Todd Zeal, you know, I never gave him a fair shake because of the loss or the departure of John Olerud. So Todd Zeal never got a fair shake from me, despite him helping us win the National League Championship. Pete Harnish, you're right. He left under not so, happy terms with the club. But he was a local kid, wasn't he, from Long Island? Can anyone confirm or deny that?
Yeah, Comac, I think.
And unfortunately for Craig Swan, he could never stay healthy. He won an ERA title, and you're right, Rich. He was the man on the mound for those pretty dark years, 77 through 79 and 80.
Yep, and Craig Swan, again, tip of the cap to him for laboring on under some very bad labor conditions. So Mike, thank you, and we'll go to Gary next. So Gary, who sticks out to you from number 27 perspective?
Well, the first one that came to my mind, of course, was Craig Swan, and he's really a nice guy. I had the pleasure to interview him last year, I believe it was, and he's retired, living in Florida, and got a lot of great stories. So he's one guy that stuck out, and as you said, couldn't stay healthy, but had won the ERA for the team. I think it was 78. Greg can probably verify that for me. The other guy that sticks out is Don Cardwell.
Mm-hmm.
Young guys aren't going to know who the heck Don Cardwell was, but he was here from. I think he got it 67 or so, and he was on the World Series team in 69 and didn't really distinguish himself, but greatly, but he had a good presence and helped. He was a veteran pitcher, and he helped that pitching staff, which were relatively very young at that time, Steve Rikuzman, Ryan, and Gentry, and really helped keep it in balance. And he hit a home run to win a game. You know, Greg, my memory's going at my age, I guess. So I can't remember the game exactly, but he won a big game.
Well, he
won one of the 1-0 doubleheader games.
Yeah, he and Jerry Kuzman each drove in the 1-0 the hits that made it 1-0.
Right. And I think he hit a home run, if I'm not
He was a great hitting. I did not see his career, but I know that he was a great hitting pitcher, and he had a lot of home runs, not just for the Mets, but I think with the Pirates as well, and the Cubs.
And the other guy that sticks out in my mind looking at the list is Mike Glavin. Because him of the perfect, if I'm not mistaken, he was 1-for-1 as a Met and got a base hit there and has the highest batting average of all time, if you don't take at-bats and into account. And he was also the brother of Tom Glavin.
The poster boy for nepotism.
There you go.
There you go. There you go. Gary, thank you. Long Island Mike, do you care to mix it up with the old men, talking about old Mets here? Do you have any thoughts on number 27?
I don't have any real old, but I have Carlos Gomez.
Nice.
I don't know why I always thought he was going to be something, and which he is now, of course. But I don't know why we got rid of him. That's all I can say.
You know,
well, think for a guy named Johan Santana.
Yep.
True. You have to give something to get something. But Gomez is one of those guys that I loved him when he came up. Speed. You could see the power would get there. Great. I mean, blazing speed. And outstanding defense, and you knew that this young man would just get better. And, Greg, I've saved you for last for a reason. If you'd like to share your thoughts on number 27 with us.
Well, you guys have taken most of the relatively famous and even some of the obscure ones, but I am going to throw down with Dennis Cook, number 27 for the Bobby Valentine Mets of 98-01. Really an important part of that bullpen. The first lefty specialist, although he was more than a one-batter guy, but the first lefty out of the bullpen, guy you would call in to get a lefty out, who actually got lefties out in about, and I'm not exaggerating, about 15 years. The Mets went through so many awful left-handed specialists and would-be specialists, roughly from the time they traded Carlos Diaz in a give up something to get something trade with Diaz and Bob Baylor to get Sid Fernandez, which is a great trade, but you were giving up a good utility man and a good left-handed reliever, and they were just the dregs. I won't go through all their names, but Dennis Cook, coming off the world champion Marlin year at 97, their fire sale, huge for the Mets, 98-99, began to lose his magic a little bit as the years went on. But he was part of one of the great Met bullpens, which was, you know, Benitez, Franco, Wendell, and Mr. Cook. And another year when the Mets actually had a good bullpen, 2006, Darren Oliver gave the Mets a very solid long man. He helped save their bacon in one of the playoff games against the Cardinals that year. So, I will throw in one more. Mike Jacobs, who stayed on the team almost by accident in 2005, one of these guys who they were planning on sending down. He pinch hit a three-run homer in a loss. Pedro Martinez lobbied for him to stay on the team, and he went out to Arizona and had a hellacious series. The Mets scored ridiculous amounts of runs behind Mike Jacobs and Victor Diaz in particular. And we figured we are set. We have the infield of the future with Jacobs at first, and soon enough Anderson Hernandez at second base, plus Reyes and Wright. Didn't quite work out that way, and Jacobs became fodder to get Carlos Delgado. So a lot of interesting names kind of circling around Craig Swan. But with apologies to Mr. Cook and Mr. Cardwell and someday Mr. Familia, perhaps, it is Craig Swan's number now and forever.
Like it. So, Greg, on Dennis Cook, correct me if I'm wrong on this one, but didn't he have a brush-up with Joe West where there was a bench-clearing brawl and Joe West was trying to break it up and he body-slammed Dennis Cook? Am I right on that?
Yeah, it was a Met game. There was a lot of crazy things going on that game. Gooden was pitching. I think this was the, and I'm sure we went through this in the number 24 review. This was the night Kelvin Torvey got a big hit wearing number 24. It was a crazy Met Philly game in 1990. And Cook had a temper to begin with. You may recall late in the 99 season when they were on that almost season-killing seven-game losing streak. Cook just got ball four called on him. I don't remember who the umpire was, but he got himself thrown out of the game immediately, and it was about the low point of the season. Things started looking up the next night, but Dennis Cook was a fun pitcher to watch, and he, like I said, very good left-handed pitcher, and he was a difference maker.
Definitely. All right, guys, we have 3 minutes left and just enough time for the last word. You guys know the drill. You've all been on before, so we're going to start with Long Island Mike here. Leave us with one final thought. Here we are, March 8th, where baseball is happening in Port St. Lucie. We're about 3 weeks from opening day. So, Long Island Michael, what do you have to say? Last word.
Get excited for the baseball season. This one's going to be a good one.
I like it. Short and to the point, what we all want to hear. Nicely done, Michael. So, Gary, we'll go to you next. What is your last word tonight?
I'm going to agree with Mike. Just enjoy it. Sit back, enjoy the ride. And I think it's going to be a great year, and have fun with it.
Good. Enjoy it, right? That's what it's all about. And you know, I'm one of those people. I can enjoy baseball if they're 62 and 100. I really can because I just love the game so much. But, damn, it's so much easier to enjoy when they're winning. Mr. Prince.
Chew that.
What is your last word for the evening?
My last word is the 2016 Mets are going to be great, and the 2015 Mets already were great. Amazing again, available now on Amazon and other fine online booksellers in stores March 15th.
I'll be buying mine. Thanks, Greg. And Mike LeCollant, my fellow staff writer here at Rising Apple, what's your last word tonight?
Oh, let me totally poo-poo the moment then. I do not appreciate Jacob deGrom not signing his deal. Okay, he's Mets property. He doesn't have to. That's what he's going to get. That's the structure in place. I don't begrudge players trying to make as much money as they possibly can. Okay, but there's a time and a place and a format for that. He has to wait for arbitration, and he has to wait for free agency, or he has to wait for the benevolence of the New York Mets organization. That said, I don't know what his tactic was. Don't appreciate it, not in this context. But whatever, here it is, our first and hopefully our only minor controversy of spring training to date. I'm just pissed off that the whole thing has been handled this way. Like I said, there's a proper way of going about this. And he didn't play by the rules. Him and his agent didn't play by the rules. And I got a problem with that. And secondly, like I told you last week, Rich, I'm using my final word to champion a cause It's time for Joan Payson Memorial at Citi Field. Let's get that done.
Hear, hear.
Yeah.
I like it. I like it. Gentlemen, we are so efficient. By my clock, we have 22 seconds left.
Wow.
Appreciate the efficiency of this podcast. I appreciate the breadth of topics we discussed. Gary and Long Island Michael, thank you for joining us. Greg, as always, a pleasure having you join our airwaves. Mike LeCollin, always fun working with you, sir. Everyone have a great night. Let's go Mets, and enjoy the rest of spring training, and let's get the season started. Good night, everybody.
Good night. Thank you.
Bye. Good night.